Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. It was Democrat Day at the State Fair. Opportunity for Governor Jelly Belly to peruse the butter cows and whatnot.
You didn't mention anything about my cow noise.
It's pretty good. Enjoy a healthy helping of fried Snickers on a stick.
Okay, this is where he's returning to the scene of the crime, because remember, he broke his femur 3 years ago because he was standing at the state fair.
It was a modern medical and engineering miracle yesterday, because not only was he standing at the state fair, but he was standing on a platform.
Oh my!
And neither one gave out. This is what he had to say. Where was his focus, do you think?
Okay, I'm ready.
Democrats, that's the Democrats deliver, and we've delivered so much over the last 4 years. I had to bring a cheat sheet. We delivered raising the minimum wage to $15. We ended right to work in this state. We expanded health care to 150,000 more people. We made Illinois a leader in clean energy. We saved lives and livelihoods through the pandemic.
Oh, that is such a lie. Liar.
Schools. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Since he was nice enough to create a cheat sheet, I think we could be nice enough to review his stated accomplishments and get your reaction as to which was the most impactful on your life. I mean, I guess his saving your life would be the most impactful.
That is, but the fact that he said the saving lives and livelihoods, when I brought that up at press conferences, you know, you're choosing to save lives over people's livelihoods, they snickered and went, oh, how dare you ask that question.
Well, it was never lives over livelihoods. It was some lives versus other lives,
right,
and some livelihoods versus other livelihoods.
Right. Some businesses stayed open. Some were deemed, you know, non-essential, so then they had to close, and some never reopened again. I'm going to tap with Pritzker for the past 4 years. What he's done for us is kill children, because more suicides happen because of the lockdowns, because of COVID, than actual kids dying from COVID. And that's not a hyperbolical statement, but that's what I will ever, and I will never forgive him for it, and I never will forget what he did or forgive him, and I think I need to go to a counselor, because I'm just so upset with what he's done to our children.
I think one of the great things he did, he didn't mention it, but he should have, was introduce us to Dr. Emily Landon from the University of Chicago.
Oh, yeah. She's back, by the way, if you want to, you know.
Yeah, no.
Oh, no, because, you know, we're, are we supposed to be afraid? Are we not afraid? What's going on here in regards to monkeypox?
It's really important to remember that no children have monkeypox right now. And so the likelihood of your kid getting monkeypox in football practice or wrestling is zero, because there aren't any kids that have monkeypox. But kids can get monkeypox, and so we need to be prepared. So
she is talking out of both sides of her mouth. She's just saying no kids have monkeypox, but we should be prepared because kids can get it. Well, Dr. Landon, since you're so into the science and the data and the fact is 7 kids in the country, no one in Illinois, but 7 kids in the country have monkeypox.
I mean, there's no point in talking about
talking with them, that Valley girl up on the merits. I just want to hear what she has to
say. Okay, all right. This is what
one kid has monkeypox because his parents are gay and they
touched a towel.
The dog, the greyhound has monkeypox. Yeah, we get it.
No, this is what you should not do. The school is starting for a lot of people on Monday, Dan.
Not sharing towels, not sharing drinks or snacks, not sharing any other equipment that you use that's close to your skin. Those pinnies that you put on when you're doing scrimmage or when you're having a practice game, those need to be laundered in between uses.
What you put on when you have a scrimmage?
The red pennies that you wear.
Oh.
You know, for basketball or football. Uh-huh. Oh, wait, there's other recommendations.
Schools should be following the guidance from the IDPH, which is not crazy. It's discouraging things like close skin-to-skin contact, which isn't necessary for your kids to have a really robust and great experience at school.
Yeah. You know how I know something's crazy? When a doctor tells me this is not crazy. So what about just in terms of not crazy stuff, any guidance on dudes having sex with dudes, going to fetish parties, in the neighborhood? Any comment on that?
The
community of men who have sex with men. That's what I'm interested in.
All they asked.
Not in that way.
I mean, but all the Dr. Awardi asked was just don't have sex with anybody else for 2 weeks. That's all we're asking.
Right.
Just one, stay with the one partner, but they can't do it.
2 weeks to stop the lesions.
Can't do it.
Right.
But she does have advice for college students, you know, older students.
So don't be sharing drinks. Keep your hands to yourself. Wash your hands. Wipe things off.
Lauren Petty, NBC 5 News.
Thank you, Lauren.
Well, Dan?
Keep your hands to yourself, boy.
And wash those hands.
That's why she's got the gig at University of Chicago. This is why she's noted by, Governor Spaulding, and only Governor Spaulding, as one of the leading epidemiologists in the country. You know, on the COVID thing,
yes, sir.
Just a couple of data points in response to Jelly Belly. They're screeching at people about his wonderful accomplishments and how he saved lives and livelihoods. A Harvard University study showed the number of Illinois small businesses dropped by 10.5% between January 20 and January 22. One in 10 small businesses in the state gone. We're 100,000 jobs down. The National Bureau of Economic Research gave Illinois an F, as in fail, for health, education, and economic outcomes. The group found Illinois was the sixth worst state in positive outcomes from policies implemented during the pandemic. Oh, by the way, you know, $15 minimum wage and narrowing the income inequality gap. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Wallet Hub has ranked Illinois the worst state for economic inequality. Worst state. And that's, even compared to California with San Francisco, which is the city that has the most income inequality in the country. Okay. Illinois Policy Institute, 61% decline between October 19 and October 20 in self-employed owners of retail stores. 6 out of every 10 gone. Now, some have come back, of course, but that's what happened.
Goodness.
Of course, we persist to this day. I mean, literally this day, with Illinois under a state of emergency order for COVID.
But he's at the state. If we're under a state of emergency, why is Pritzker out and about at the state fair? It's too dangerous for him, especially people who are obese, because studies, we know, that close to 80% of the people who were severely ill with COVID and died are obese.
The lockdowns, all the mandates. Yeah. Illinois had the fifth highest number of cases in the United States and the eighth highest number of deaths. In other words, all that he did that he said was about saving lives and saving livelihoods just amounted to making things worse. You were never going to stop the spread. Which is what they quickly settled on. And locking things down and these idiotic mandates and their associated mantras did very little. And now with what we're learning about the vaccine from the real-world observations, and now the vaccinated are treated the same as the unvaccinated, that's CDC guidance now, even as the COVIDians in public office and their henchmen on Twitter continue to propagate the propaganda. Yeah. You know, it seems to me that if you can't hold a governor or a mayor responsible for that kind of catastrophic public policy, I'm talking about Pritzker and COVID specifically. Yep. If you can't hold that person accountable, do like a sober assessment of what the promises were and what the deliverables ended up being. Well, then it's a couple things. One, you're not a serious person. Two, you're not a sovereign person. You're a mindless sentinel of the state, and there's no getting to you. And if you, that profile becomes the majority, there is no salvaging that city or state. So we're going to find out on November 8th and then again in February if Chicago and Illinois fit into that category or not. I mean, really. I know the conventional wisdom is, oh, you know, he was able to buffalo enough people and you're not supposed to talk about COVID. This is what a lot of Republicans, these surrender Republicans, are telling candidates and so on and so forth. You know, you have to make arguments. You have to tell people, here's what you thought. Or here's what some of you thought. Here's what the promise was. And just so you know, in case you haven't been paying attention,
this is the outcome.
Yeah, here are the outcomes.
So we are the fifth now, highest cases in the state and the eighth highest death
in the country. Huh. Yeah. And so now what is it? What do you say to that? You're sure you want to continue on this track? That's the choice.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, former Vice President Mark Pence. I think he was at St. Anselm College addressing the raid on Mar-a-Lago and the state of the FBI, the confidence that Americans should have or not have in that agency. And he said this to those who, as we've had some discussions over the last week, are arguing for a disbanding or, dare we say, defunding of the FBI.
Earlier today and elsewhere, I also want to remind my fellow Republicans, we can hold the Attorney General accountable for the decision that he made without attacking rank and file law enforcement personnel at the FBI. The Republican Party is the party of law and order.
Yeah, defunding the FBI is no more legitimate than defunding police is what Pence said.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
You know, I think it's a bit disingenuous of Mike Pence to make that argument. I think it's sort of transparent pandering. I know he also has problems with the raid that was conducted on Mar-a-Lago, and as you heard him say, hold AG Garland accountable for the decision he made. To compare defunding the police to the conversation about the FBI right now is a false equivalence. And he should know better. Nobody is suggesting that FBI agents be replaced with social workers.
Right.
Nobody is suggesting that there is not a legitimate function for federal law enforcement. We had this conversation yesterday with Harvey Silverglate, former criminal defense attorney, author of Three Felonies a Day, founder, co-founder of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education, libertarian sort. And even he, talking about abolishing the FBI, is talking about abolish that agency in its current form and stand up something that where you can rebuild essentially a corporate slash law enforcement culture from the ground up. One other thing. It's really tiresome. Just a couple things that should frame every conversation with reasonable people so it doesn't we don't have to spend time saying it. One, nobody is interested in protecting cops who abuse their power or break the law.
Heck no.
Two, nobody is attacking federal law enforcement officers who do their job and they're not part of the politicization of the agency. So can you just spare me with the virtue signaling nonsense, Mike Pence and everybody else about it? We get it. We're reasonable people. Nobody wants to protect wrongdoers and nobody wants to indict people doing their job and protecting people and doing good work. I'm not saying this about... Yeah, no, we know. Stop it. It's ridiculous. And you look ridiculous, okay?
Well, what about his plea to, you know, beg people to stop, you know, threatening federal agents and government facilities since the search of...
Again.
Because I know...
Ridiculous.
We both know FBI agents here in Chicago.
Ridiculous statement.
Well, but it's not if it's not happening.
Is there anybody who is rallying to the defense of people who are making threats or committing acts of violence? No. I'm against violence. Good for you. You're a kindergartner. I'm against making threats. Good for you. You're a kindergartner.
Well, do you think he's just trying to help calm the storm?
No.
Trump said, too, that he'll...
I think he's pandering. Okay. That's what I think he's doing.
312-642-5600, Turnkey Deb Pro Answer Line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment, because I was told there's people, you know, loitering outside the Chicago offices. There's some crazy nut job in Pennsylvania who's posting FBI agents' names and their addresses and their family members' names.
Yeah, that's, I know. It's a real concern when FBI agents get doxxed by whoever's, by perceived Trump supporters. You know, when it goes the other way, or frankly, an assassination attempt on a Supreme Court justice. Do we have everybody do a performative, hey, don't try to assassinate Supreme Court justices from the left? No, we don't. Just stop it. It's ridiculous. Of course. Yes. Thank you for reminding us. I mean, I guess you have to say it to some extent, but can we get past the refrigerator magnet sayings and have a conversation that's serious about a serious topic? Like the performance of the FBI, the role that it should or should not play in a free society, whether it's just a matter of a leadership change or and hopefully a culture change that accompanies it, or you really need to reconstitute the agency and narrow the scope. Maybe we do need to have the conversation that Harvey Silverglate said yesterday is much more difficult than dealing with the agency, which is about federal criminal law. And the wide berth the FBI has to bring everything that could that involves the use of federal communication infrastructure, national communication infrastructure, under the umbrella of, you know, wire fraud. Those are the conversations we have to have. Yeah, nobody reasonable, nobody sensible is promoting violence for political ends. Nobody reasonable and sensible is attacking people who are otherwise doing the work that we expect them to do in law enforcement. This is a way to not have those conversations that are more complicated by just saying, I'm on the side of right. I'm against wrong. Congratulations. Now where do we go? By the way, if there are people loitering outside the office or otherwise committing
arrest
crimes,
them.
You're federal law enforcement.
I know.
Anybody you can call? I mean, it's so ridiculous. Come on. We have to talk about national security function for the FBI or not.
They've made some horrible mistakes.
We have to talk about the sort of accountability mechanisms. And the same thing at Justice. Kevin Kleinsmith doctors an email and he gets a slap on FBI in a case involving the President of the United States. And he gets a slap on the wrist, and I believe his law license was just reinstated. Are you serious?
Yeah, it was reinstated last week. I know.
And in addition to the senior leadership from Comey to McCabe to the Lovebirds to number three over at DOJ. I mean, come on. Marvin in Burlington, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. Hey, Marvin.
It's good to I listen every day, even though I don't call in every day. But I gotta agree with you 100%. I just don't. I mean, it's if Peter Strzok and Lisa Page are not the rank and file, then who is the rank and file? I mean, you know, don't.
Well, I mean, there's 40,000 or something agents, but
right,
so,
but
yeah.
But it's not just Lisa Page and Peter Strzok. There's others under them that are involved in all this stuff. So, I mean, and then if you look at any agency that the federal government is in control of, and what my personal one is the Department of Education. I mean, what a waste of money, and what a total failure of bureaucratic nonsense. I mean, did we not conquer other diseases before? And go to the moon and other achievements in the United States before we had the great Department of Education? Are you kidding me? These people are eggheads with no common sense.
I wish thanks for the call, Marvin. I wish they were eggheads. I wish they were bright and just, you know, not worldly. No, the people that we're talking about are, you know, grifters. And buffoons, some combination of the two. Oh, speaking of good people, rank and file at the FBI, how about these good people that Jim Jordan talked about on Sunday night with Trey Gowdy?
Understand the template here. The template never changes with these guys. It's the left creates a lie. Big media, mainstream press reports the lie. Big tech amplifies the lie. And then when we try to tell the truth, they call us names and try to cancel us and tell us and tell the world that, oh, we're the ones not being square with them. So the country, though, the good news is they figured it out. And I'll tell you who else has figured it out, Trey. And you and John, with your background in law enforcement, appreciate this. 14 FBI agents have come to our office as whistleblowers, and they are good people. There are lots of good people in the FBI. It's the top that's the problem. But some of these good agents are coming to us telling us this is baloney what's going on, the political nature now of the Justice Department. God bless them for doing it, coming and talking to us about the school board issue, about a whole host of issues. I mean, it's becoming a well-worn trail of agents who say this has got to stop, and thank goodness for them, and thank goodness that the American people recognizes it, and I believe they're going to make a big change on November 8th.
14 whistleblowers.
Wow.
Good.
That is good.
By the way, this is all against the backdrop of the ongoing saga and fallout from the raid. And we'll talk about that at the bottom of the 8 o'clock hour with Alan Dershowitz.
But can't wait.
Wall Street Journal opining on the topic. You know, the funny thing about the DOJ and the FBI, they're transparent about things they want you to know, and they're not transparent about things that you should know.
Bingo.
So it's not for, you know, you can, again, wave the transparency flag all you want, and then you give us the, you know, the property receipt in terms of what was taken from Mar-a-Lago so that everybody sees that you're operating with an eye towards the Espionage Act, and we can debate whether or not President Trump could be charged under the Espionage Act and what that would look like and so on and so forth. And yet, when it comes to the predicate to seek the search warrant, to do the raid, you know, the representations that were made before the court to clear the probable cause hurdle, oh, we don't get to see that. The DOJ working to block the release of the affidavit.
Yeah, and today they go to court in Florida because a lot of news stations filed FOIA requests for it.
And The Wall Street Journal opining, unseal the Mar-a-Lago search affidavit. And by the way, President Trump wants it unsealed, too.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting?
And he's debating whether or not to release surveillance footage of the FBI raids.
It did contain the documents. Well, here's the Wall Street Journal editorial board. Last week, someone told the Washington Post that Justice believes Trump had documents related to nuclear secrets, but the warrant revealed no such evidence. It did contain a reference to a possible violation of the Espionage Act, but again, without evidence or elaboration. Mr. Trump and the public deserve to know more about why and how he might be charged with a crime, period, full stop. Yeah, exactly. And why not? It's going to jeopardize the investigation? Hardly. Spare me. Chuck and Delavan.
Hey, I agree with you, Dan. Pence never would have been the governor of Indiana ever again.
Okay.
With Donald Trump. The biggest problem Donald Trump made when he got in office, the biggest problem he got in was back home. He should have fired everybody in that FBI, that office, because he could have said, okay, where were the whistleblowers when Strzok and Page were doing it? You didn't know that any of this was going on? He should have fired every single one of them and put a whole different group of FBI agents in there. That's what started this whole thing. He wouldn't have had that happen to him. And people going through his wife's underwear drawer. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Chuck. I knew Chuck would take judicial notice of that. Tom in Deer Park.
Hang Mike Pence. No, wait, wrong call. Sorry. Dan, Amy, good morning.
Good morning.
Not defunding the GOP until about 5 minutes ago, that wouldn't even be standard boilerplate GOP. It wouldn't come out of anyone's mouth. But, well, we've got MAGA world now, so we're going to lump the FBI with the Capitol Police and pummel and pound on them. They don't exist, and the violence against them doesn't exist. We just back the blue when it's convenient for our listeners in Chicago.
You're an idiot, and you don't listen. You didn't listen to a word that was said. You had the statement that you had scrawled out on an envelope, and you were so excited to just deliver it, in spite of everything that was said for the last 10 minutes. That's the difficulty, is you have to deal with people who are not reasonable, who are not listening, who just have prepared remarks that they're going to recite no matter what your position is. By the way, correcting the record on something from yesterday when we were talking about crime in Chicagoland and Chicago coming to the suburbs, the event in Wilmette where there was a robbery and a police chase.
They crashed into a building.
Open fire on police. That was one. And then I mentioned this other incident in Wheaton, where a car was stolen out of the parking lot of Chicago Golf Club, of all places. They stole some laptops and cash from other cars. They took off. They abandoned the car in Lombard, stole another car, and went on their merry way. I said, because that was my understanding, that there was a no-chase policy in effect in Lombard. And I got a tweet on that saying, Dan, big fan of your show, listen every day. Here I have to push back on you for Lombard PD. We can and do chase criminals. In this case, the car was abandoned in the bank lot and offenders went off in the second car. We got the call after the car was abandoned the golf clubs were gone. So correct the record. Apologize for that. So Lombard police are not under a no chase order, which is good to know. Jim in Lyle, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Amy. Good morning, Dan. Dan, John Carlin, the former head of the Justice Department's National Security Division in 2016, resigned suddenly 3 weeks before Trump won. He's now the number three in the Justice Department currently. Hmm. His sudden resignation has never been fully explained or looked into. It's because he was involved with the FISA shenanigans, and General Rogers asked him for a report on it. Why is he the number three currently in the Justice Department?
Yeah, his name has been mentioned. Thanks for the call, Jim. And we talked about this on Monday with respect to some of the comments from Kash Patel and Devin Nunes over the weekend on Maria Bartiromo's show. It's the same people running the same deal for the last 15 years. Two Obama administrations, one Hillary Clinton campaign, one Donald Trump presidency. Same people in slightly different roles and slightly different places, but running the same scam with some of their people holdovers throughout those 15 years in different positions within the government, including law enforcement. Jake Sullivan, now NSA. Susan Rice, now domestic policy advisor. Lisa Monaco, now number two at DOJ. They all date back to the Obama administration. And it's funny to listen to a never Trump blathering idiot like Tom in Deer Park, because he's emblematic of so many people in the never Trump, used to be conservative as well as on the left, which is they're completely indifferent to accountability. Any discussion of holding people with immense power accountable for how they wield that power. These otherwise conservatives who believe in small government, the power of the individual, and we understand as the state grows, the individual shrinks. But you can't have a discussion of CIA or DOJ or FBI, because I thought you were for law and order. I thought you were for national security. Yeah, I'm for all those things and holding people to account, including at the local level, police departments and city governments and state governments, for what they do and do not do with the power they wield. How straightforward is that? But instead, we have to listen to the posturing of boneheads like Tom in Deer Park and of, you know, frankly, panderers like Mike Pence, who is wont to speak in banalities, as he did yesterday.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy talking about another federal agency that has become way too central in our lives, in addition to the FBI we were talking about last hour, and DOJ. The CDC, and here again, like we had with the entrance of Christopher Wray, nobody did anything wrong, but we're going to institute some reforms.
Yeah, Dr. Walensky admitted yesterday that the CDC had poor messaging and confusing guidance. And now they want to, are you ready for this? They want a new mandate for Congress. Well, they're asking for a new mandate from Congress for new powers. They want special forces, CDC special forces.
We need to have a special forces, if you will, to deploy during pandemic times.
Do you think they're up to the task of now changing their whole culture and thinking of themselves more like special forces that can be deployed wherever they're needed?
I have no doubt that they're up to the task.
That idiot reporter from CBS did a really bad job of asking her
CDC special forces. Oh, I'm looking forward to that. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. You can't have enough federal bureaucrats with shoot-to-kill powers. Federal special forces deploy, make sure people are standing in their idiot circles, make sure their mask is above their nose.
What that reporter should have asked her, what exactly does it mean to be on the CDC special forces? But also, are you ready for this? They want to mandate that local jurisdictions share their data accurately. How are they going to do that? And of course, I'm all about timing. So this comes out with the CDC just walking up to an apology but not making an apology on the same day that American Greatness, and you could read this article, we should tweet it out, americangreatness.com. All right, 44% of pregnant women in the Pfizer trial lost their babies. And still the FDA and the CDC recommended jabs for expectant mothers.
You got to look, I got to dig into that.
I mean,
that.
This is sickening.
Okay, so.
Well, 50 pregnant here. Women and 22 of them lost their babies, according to the, it's part of that Pfizer document dump that was ordered by the judge that's going to take, 40 years to come out?
Yeah, Naomi Wolf, who's not beyond reproach, to be generous, ran a crowdsourced project to analyze 300,000 Pfizer documents released via FOIA request. 44% of pregnant women who participated in drug makers' COVID-19 vaccine trial lost their babies. That needs more digging into, but it certainly does prompt questions about how Pfizer interpreted that trial, the results of that trial, what they represented to FDA and CDC, what FDA and CDC represented to the public, and specifically, of course, pregnant women. So that's an issue.
Those are babies. Those are a lot of women have miscarried, but that is almost half of the women. And still the FDA and the CDC told pregnant women to take the shot. They knew that they were miscarrying and they didn't care.
Yeah, there's some
because it didn't fit in their agenda. It's like, no, we got to keep doing this.
Well, again, I haven't had the opportunity to dig into the details, and it's not my area of expertise either. I mean, I can do it at a basic level, but we're going to get one of our, epidemiologist friends to come on and talk about these studies that are coming out. This is what we were mentioning last hour when we were talking about Governor Jelly Belly at the state fair touting how he saved all these lives and livelihoods with his lockdown policies and vaccine mandates. And there's more studies coming out about said vaccines because that's what's really material right now.
The trial documents also revealed that Pfizer had to hire 1,800 additional full-time employees in the first half of 2021 to deal with, quote unquote, the large increase of adverse reactions to its COVID vaccine.
A new study out of Thailand detailing heart inflammation cases among young boys after they were given an mRNA vaccine. Dr. Vinay Prasad writes, the study does matter. It's important. It's the first prospective study of biomarkers post-vaccine. It's concerning. It captures so many failures with drug safety. The authors ran a bunch of tests on kids, 202 boys, 99 girls, aged 13 to 18, who got the second dose of Pfizer after getting the first dose without adverse events. The EKG changes in the preprint are not in the story. The story are rates of cardiac biomarkers and how often they are elevated. Three patients had chest pains and biomarker elevation. Four patients had no chest pains but elevated cardiac biomarkers. These were all in boys. Seven of 202 boys had overt subclinical myocarditis, a roughly two orders of magnitude more common than prior reports from passive adverse event reporting of myocarditis. So you're talking about, again, we're talking about these being relatively rare, but in comparison to the proposed benefit for young boys and girls, but particularly boys, given what Dr. Prasad lays out here, give the benefit. And also now think about this with respect to what the risk profiles were for getting COVID in the first place, particularly for young people. So you're talking about
low risk group,
talking about evidence of heart damage in 2.33% of vaccinated school-age participants, according to the authors of this Thai study. And 2.33%. When you're talking about at 0.1% to 0.5% across a population of 330 million people, I mean, that's obviously the population of America, but even breaking that down to, say, 50 million under the age of 18, you're talking about a lot of people. And again, this has to be put in context. The risk of that versus the risk of getting COVID for the same population.
Right.
And suffering serious and long-lasting consequences from it. It's trade-offs. It's risk assessment. The sorts of things that we didn't do.
But we didn't have choices because either get your kids vaccinated or they're going to be locked out of their school. So a lot of parents, including myself, we were forced into vaccinating our kids so that they could have a life, so that they could play sports, so that they could see their friends. They shoved this down our throat.
There's this, too, out of New Zealand. National vaccine monitoring data from New Zealand show Pfizer's mRNA COVID shot is associated with above normal death rates in teenagers and young adults for weeks after their jab. Alex Berenson writes, the signal is subtle, does not prove the vaccines are behind the extra deaths, so just pump the brakes. But they are another warning sign for the mRNA vaccines, which are already known to increase the rates of myocarditis in young men. And again, effectively have no benefit for healthy young people in any case. And yet we still have colleges, school districts, K through 12 school districts like in D.C. mandating vaccines 12 up, or in the case of colleges, obviously, for the most part, 18 and up.
Back to the 22 out of the 50 women who were part of this trial who lost their babies, who miscarried. Pfizer apparently took those deaths and put them down as recovered, resolved adverse effects. Similar to, you know, getting a headache. I mean, this is so fraudulent, and just I feel sick for these women who lost their babies. 22.
And so now we have, you know, now comes Dr. Rochelle Walensky in an email to CDC. In an email to CDC employees yesterday afternoon about how she's going to overhaul the agency. In our big moment, our performance did not reliably meet expectations. My goal is a new public health action-oriented culture at CDC that emphasizes accountability, collaboration, blah, 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 cultural shift, blah, blah, blah.
New equity officer.
Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
It's all corporate speak that doesn't really tell you what, if anything, is going to be done. Because here's the point of it. Very much like what Christopher Wray outlined when he took the helm at FBI. Sort of generic problem areas and generic prescriptions to deal with those problem areas. The lack of specificity is the tell when it comes to these things. If you're not talking, if you're talking to, we are going to institute accountability reforms to blah, what are you going to do? What are you going to specifically do with respect to your interaction with the public, in the case of CDC, with and FBI for them, any government agency, with those public health professionals and politicians at the local level? How are you going to address those who raise questions or offer dissent? You want a culture change? As we've talked about with Dr. Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford and others, one of the greatest crimes the CDC committed was our communication could have been better. No. One of the greatest crimes that you did, that they committed, was to attack people who were following the scientific method, attack scientists
and
equally credentialed scientists and doctors, public health professionals, attack them for raising questions or disagreeing. Attack them for following the scientific method. You lied. You essentially, you eliminated science from the conversation when you said the science is settled. When Tony Fauci said, I am science.
Yeah.
That's the end of science. So you got to do a little bit more than talk in vague terms about accountability when you've committed offenses against the people as grave as the CDC has committed.
And I think now their biggest crime is knowing what they knew about the COVID vaccine and miscarriages and told pregnant women to take the shot anyway. Save your baby's life. I remember that was one of the slogans. And the White House responded, Dr. Zha.
Let's remind ourselves that Dr. Walensky, the director of the CDC, asked for this review of the CDC. I think that review was very well done. It laid out areas where the CDC needs to improve. And the bottom line is that she's committed to making those changes. And I think that's really important.
Yeah. Okay. And still, in the same breath, pushing the third jab.
Two shots is not enough. People need at least three. I think three provides that very high level of protection. And then just like the flu vaccine, where people need to get updated once a year, we probably need to continue to get updated with COVID vaccines on an ongoing basis.
It's an old ruse, wonderfully memorialized in a very underappreciated show that unfortunately only had two seasons. But Kelsey Grammer as the mayor of Chicago in The Boss. Change on the outside to protect continuity on the inside. The appearance of change to protect the way we do things. That's what you're getting. Tom in Oswego.
Morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, you hit it on the head. It's the appearance of change. They're already doing it with the Inflation Reduction Act. I think what frustrates me most about all of this is when this started, I told my wife, we're going to feel the ramifications of the government shutdown, not the virus itself, the shutdown for years to come, and we won't know how to handle this. What frustrates me at the top of my list is, where did the trillions of dollars go? Trillions. It used to be a word we joked about when we were kids. You know, you used to make fun of, oh, $1 trillion. Now we throw it around like it's a billion. Where did all that money go? There needs to be an accounting. And when, Amy, you say that there's crimes, you know, with the CDC, you know, a crime is when somebody gets, you know, charged with something and gets in trouble. These people are going to get promoted. There's no crimes as far as they're concerned.
No. I wish they could get sued, but they can't get sued because they all signed waivers.
Thanks, Tom. Lucy, Lowell, Indiana.
Yes. One thing that perhaps you could look into is, I remember reading things that said that, I don't know, when they wanted to take these COVID vaccines to like more of the underdeveloped countries and stuff like that, if they didn't have money to pay for the COVID vaccine, then they were demanding that they turn over military bases or airfields in payment for the vaccine.
Who's they were demanding?
I don't remember. I read this like 2 years ago, but that's why I say maybe if you look into this, you could find that, because they were asking for those military bases or the airfields in the countries, and that goes along with making special forces for the CDC. They're kind of in the same vein.
Well,
I'm sorry, I don't remember the particulars.
Thanks for the call, Lucy. It's all right, but I mean, I don't know that there's any evidence that America was doing anything of the sort, but. Okay. Kip, Stillman Valley.
Yeah, here you go, the government going out, not enforcing the true correct things of laws like the CDC and like our border security, breaking it or saying that it's broken because they're not following what the laws and what the rules are for organizations in order to make us safe. And then they want to transform it in their image. And who are we going to get the marching orders of the CDC to have special investigators or whatever, more IRS? Are we going to get the marching order from Wuhan, from the WHO, from the UN, and how we should do keep our darn nation safe from these predators that are Marxists and the world order?
Thanks for the call, Kip. So the special forces thing. I assume she means sort of like rapid response teams of public health professionals. Right, but the problem is, you say special forces, it invokes the military,
right,
of course. And so I presume, I mean, I guess I'll give her the benefit of the doubt, though she certainly hasn't earned it, that she's not talking about military-style personnel at CDC.
Sounds like it, though, doesn't it? Because they're going to arm the IRS agents. What are they going to do with the CDC special forces?
I mean, not all of them. There's no need to overstate the argument. But it's just, she's complaining about, or she's, you know, doing a mea culpa about their communication, and then she uses a phrase like something like the special forces, which is terrible comms, because it, you know, of course, foments all of the images of what, you know, well, you're going to have somebody, you know, pointing a gun at me to make sure I'm standing in my idiot circle. These people, I mean, they're just.
Well, it was strange enough that, you know, you'd members of the military giving you shots. And that's how, you know, they took over the United Center. That's how they were dispersed. They used the Illinois National Guard.
Well, right.
Every state used their. Well, yeah, I don't know about every state.
Yeah. Like you have different agencies doing different things. And there's, you know, specific chains of command. But the CDC doesn't scramble the National Guard. So the question is, you know, you have to get into the specifics here. And also, somebody needs to start talking to these people like they're equals rather than genuflecting before them, asking them questions like they're speaking to the Oracle of Delphi, because you never get any freaking answers. You just get their pap and their nonsense. And when they say something like special forces, oh, you think they're up to the challenge of special forces? Come on.
It's stupid.
Brain dead. Paul and Kerry.
Hey, guys. You know, any sensible person seen this coming, I'm a Republican, conservative Republican, and even in our McHenry County, Mike Bueller and everybody else is all happy to dip into those ARPA funds, the COVID relief funds. They got shiny new buses. They put some to the McHenry County College, a couple million here, a couple million there. Just as long as they comply with Pritzker's mandate. So everybody's guilty with dipping. It's so unfortunate. For 2 years, we all had to suffer. Our children, for 2 years, were at the mercy of this governor. How despicable.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Paul.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka, today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, we got another one. Remember the story out of Wilmette about 4 years ago? The mom in Wilmette who was investigated investigated by DCFS for letting her 8-year-old daughter walk the dog around the block.
Dog. Yeah. And go to the park sometimes by herself. Walk the dog, though, so that's a safety mechanism.
Yeah, all these agencies in charged with protecting children. And what's the record of DCFS in Illinois?
8 deaths in the past, 2 months? Or no, 9. I'm sorry, it was 9.
In Arizona, we got an interesting case on this topic. You know, government doing everything for the kids.
It's always about the children.
This reported in Reason Magazine. It was a pleasant November day in Tucson, and Sarah needed to procure Thanksgiving turkey. The COVID pandemic was still raging. This was fall of 2020, before the vaccines had been made available and so forth. And the supermarket's policy was to discourage excess people from entering the premise. Sarah opted to let her 7-year-old son and 5-year-old friend play at the park while she ran the errand. She instructed her kids to wait for her by the jungle gym. She took note of an adult acquaintance teaching a Tai Chi class in the park, and Sarah told her kids to consult the friend who was teaching the Tai Chi class in the event of any problems. Okay. She then left to buy her turkey. And the state of Arizona has decided that incident demonstrates Sarah's unfitness to care for children. Leaving two kids to fend for themselves, even briefly, in a perfectly safe public park with an acquaintance nearby was an act of negligence in the state's view, and one that warrants Sarah's placement on the so-called central registry.
What is that?
It's not too Orwellian. People who are on the central registry in Arizona are prohibited from working with children, even in a volunteer capacity. The central registry also, and unsurprisingly, violates the basic tenets of due process in numerous ways. It's an administrative agency run by Arizona's version of the Department of Child Safety, of our DCFS, is called the Department of Child Safety. The standard for placement on the central registry is probable cause. Suspicion of wrongdoing. Probable cause.
Due process. Somebody called the snitch line and you're on there.
The standard that you use to get a search warrant to raid Mar-a-Lago. Yeah. She was in the middle of shopping, how this went down, when a friend found her in the store, informed her the police were with her kids. She raced back to the park where the police arrested her on suspicion of endangering a minor. And that was despite the fact that they weren't in danger. No one claimed they were. There's not an explicit law against letting kids play by themselves in a public park because, of course, the laws, the minor delinquency laws, are particularly vague, purposely vague. And even in states where the laws are clear, parents are customarily prosecuted for leaving kids at home, letting them walk to school by themselves, dropping them off at the playground for a few minutes of unmonitored play, and almost for letting them walk the dog, the family dog, around the block in full view of the parents. Yeah. So this is yet another instance of parents being punished by law enforcement for entrusting kids with reasonable levels of autonomy, isn't it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636 DA, turnkey.pro text line. She was arrested. She's barred for 25 years for even volunteering with anything having to do with kids because she's on the central registry.
Yeah. So she can't volunteer at the school, can't be lunchroom lady, can't be, you know,
coach,
class mom or a coach.
She
can't
worked
on field trips.
She worked out a plea deal with the prosecutor.
Oh, that's nice.
In exchange for the charges being dropped, she had to take a parenting class.
But she's still on the list.
Yeah.
That's the problem. That's the stick it right there.
Yeah. I mean, and I would argue that that central registry is unconstitutional. But, of course, you would have to make that case in a court of law to have that registry struck down. Yeah.
Within a safe part of Tucson.
And I, you know, and like with everything, I know there are instances where these child welfare agencies do good work. And then there's a lot of instances where they don't. And there's a lot of accountability for not. Again, the exposés, the, you know, every few years you get an expose to remind you that DCFS is a dumpster fire.
Oh, horrible.
Apparently the same thing in Houston, at least to a certain extent, at least with one former employee. Keisha Baisley is a Texas mother of nine who needed help with her 14-year-old daughter who was running away and causing trouble at school. So she turned to Child Protective Services in Houston. And this is what her caseworker at the Child Protective Services told Ms. Basley's daughter.
Yes, Sherman, you would think the judge overseeing the 14-year-old girl's custody case would need to know about the cell phone video, but apparently CPS didn't think so.
You'll be a home, be a real home.
She's a mother of nine, and she does have a daughter who has had some behavioral problems.
That's why Keisha Basley turned to Child Protective Services. But then her 14-year-old daughter told her when she told a CPS employee she was hungry, that worker told her to become a prostitute.
What?
The daughter recorded the CPS worker on her cell phone.
I was there. Because the worker had been, in fact, telling her, this is how you can make money. You need to do this. I used to do this, and you could do the same thing.
You're basically telling a child that lives in a hotel you can make $1,500 a day if you're a prostitute.
Right, and also, it might be something you want to do if you want to eat.
When I saw the video with that lady, it's like my soul left my body.
You had heard there, it's hard to make out, but they've got the video with the worker saying, if you want to be a hoe, you got to be a real hoe. That's what she said. That's the phrase that was used. One of the phrases that was used.
And all so, because the girl said, I'm hungry. And so you want to eat, become a prostitute.
So that's, that worker has been fired.
Oh, really? But
one has to wonder what kind of corporate culture there is at Child Protective Services in Houston that would have someone like that in their employ. I'm sure there were some of her colleagues that took notice about her approach to protecting children,
how'd she get fired in the first place? Sounds like she's a groomer too. Like, and if you do want to become, conjecture on my part, but if you do want to become a prostitute, I know a great pimp that'll help you out.
So
yeah, it's almost like,
you know, it's
sex
these are
trafficking.
These are anecdotes. I understand, and they're perhaps you could argue they're outlier cases. Maybe depending on your locale, there are less of outliers in some places than others. But it still is just sort of this, you know, deference to government as the great protector of children. And whether it's law enforcement or child welfare agencies or K through 12 school systems, I just don't believe that's the case anymore. And so we bring you examples to compare and contrast what is happening now, and we see it and we tell stories to highlight it, versus even just what the culture was around raising kids when we were kids. It's very different.
We used to go out all the time without supervision.
Greg in Elo, Michigan.
Big deal.
Talk about different. My mother used to kick us out of the house and tell us, don't come back till dinner time.
Yep.
And there'd be no, you didn't know where we were. We'd be in all kinds of mischief all day.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
I remember
those
days, and then when the sun started setting, you knew it was time to go home for dinner.
Yeah, and
cell phones.
And the argument will be, well, that was a different time, and you didn't have bad people doing bad things, but you did.
We did have bad people doing bad things.
You did. It's just different. Although you did have more intact families that produced intact communities where people looked out for one another differently
yep.
than they do today. That's a big deal.
You always knew your neighbors had your back.
Matt, South Suburb, South Side.
Hey, Dan. Yeah, I was just going to say, so parents have to know what their kids are up to all the time, you know, when they're at parks and whatever. But as far as gender and gender reassignment, that they don't need to know about.
Or correct. Or if your daughter decides that she wants to have an invasive surgical procedure, then you're not to be notified about that either.
Right.
Thanks to Governor Pritzker, one of his accomplishments he mentioned under the rubric of protecting reproductive rights, the right of a 14-year-old to have an abortion without telling her parents. Right? Isn't that wonderful?
I'm so happy. He was so elated with himself too.
Scooter, Southside.
Hey, good morning, guys. Listen, I saw that on Twitter, that story about the CPS worker, and I had a comment I put in there. Maybe she should become a CPS union.
The kid. Yeah. Thanks for the
call. Join the CPS union.
Thanks for the call, Scooter. Robert Lyle.
Yeah, hi. I was born in 1949. I went to school in Chicago on the west side off of Franklin Boulevard. And my parents and everybody used to go out all the time. We used to walk to school and everything else. And that was on the west side of Chicago near Garfield Park in that area. And that was now, I don't know if you could do that, but I'm just saying that for the most part. When we were kids growing up, there was nothing, there was no restrictions on us to do stuff like that. And the worst crime of the century, you know, the Leopold Loeb trial, that was it. Now that is like nothing compared
right.
to what's happening in the world. So we do live in a more dangerous world. So that's it, you know.
Thanks for the call, Robert. Well, we do, I mean, in a sense, but, you know, so then the question is why and what should the response be? And is this a productive use of resources to be worrying about a mom in Wilmette watching her 8-year-old walk the dog around the block, or a mom in Arizona who runs to get a turkey for Thanksgiving when you hear one at a time in grocery stores because of government policy, and leaves her kids playing on the jungle gym next to a friend teaching a Tai Chi class. Is that really a law enforcement issue? Is that a state issue? I don't think so.
It's big government.
John, Naperville.
Yes, so let me get this straight. So in the city of Chicago, a minor could be out all hours of the night, part of a gang, you know, with a gun and get shot by a police officer, and we have to change the entire foot pursuit thing instead of, you know, prosecuting the mom. Boy, that makes a lot of effing sense.
Thanks, John. Rich, Indian Head Park.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. The thing that I want to say about this woman in Arizona, does this mean if I'm her neighbor and I have kids and I ask her to watch them for an hour while I go to the bank, she can't? I mean, how far are they going to go with this?
That's
a good day.
Thanks, Rich. Yes, Central Registry. Frank, Arlington Heights.
They'll go as far as they can, no doubt about it. Good morning. When I was a little kid, I don't know if you were the same age, Dan. You remember when the Happy Meal came out for McDonald's?
I sure do.
We were like 7, 8 years old, something like that. And it was like in the shape of a little house. It was a box with a little house. And at least that's the one I remember. And I really wanted to go get one. So my mom gave me the money, went, and I lived in Niles at the time and walked, you know, 2 blocks, went through the parking lot of Jerry's Fruit Market behind the alley over there to the McDonald's, went and got it. Brought it back home. Today, I think we'd have to call it the unhappy meal with the way our society is.
Thanks, surprising. Frank.
Mom didn't get in trouble for letting him walk on the streets, the mean streets of Niles.
Vince, St. Charles.
Good morning, guys. I was a teenager. John Wayne Gacy, I grew up in Elmwood Park. John Wayne Gacy, during that heart of that time, one of my friend's brothers murdered by him. My parents still let us out of the house. But so that was the worst guy in Illinois history, I would think. So
yeah, maybe they were sending,
we were all out playing while they were maybe they covering were more bodies from his crawl space.
Maybe they were sending a message to you, Vince.
Oh,
no,
yes.
No,
oh.
I'm kidding. Yeah, thanks for the call.
He got out of Elmwood Park.
Yeah, with Tony St. Charles. Yeah,
I love Elmwood Park.
Elmwood Park success story.
Yes,
John in Libertyville.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Yeah, there was a guy, Joe Biden. He sent his young son. He told him, go to China, Russia, and Ukraine, and don't come home till you get $10
million. If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, talking about in the wake of the raid on Mar-a-Lago and so much else, talking about the laws that get enforced and the laws that don't, and on who they get enforced and on who they do not. Our friends over at Catholic Vote, Brian Birch and company, have a new ad up that speaks to something that hasn't gotten much profile. You would think would deserve more profile. But here again, enforcing the laws to protect crisis pregnancy centers or churches that are attacked by pro-abort goons. Well, that's not something we talk about because, you know, we share the political philosophy. We share the issue position. So we don't talk about it. And we certainly don't investigate it.
In the 1960s, when churches were burned, President Kennedy stepped up, condemned it.
To burn churches, I consider both cowardly as well as outrageous.
President Kennedy pledged justice.
As soon as we are able to find out who did it, we'll arrest them.
Now, churches are being burned again because they protect unborn babies and women in need. Our second Catholic president?
Keep protesting because keep making your point.
Wow. That's good.
Yeah, a bit of a distinction between JFK and Biden. And on the issue of violence, talking about violence. Oh, the hand-wringing about violence directed at the FBI in the wake of the Mar-a-Lago raid, threats and this and that. Of course,
what about the assassination attempt on Kavanaugh?
As we've said over and over again, it's just I'm so sick of being spoken to like a kindergartner. Like Mike Pence or whoever else saying, you know, violence has no place. Yeah, I know. We're not talking about that. We're talking about whether we're going to have equal justice under the law and equal and by extension, equal treatment before the law, a necessary ingredient. Or asking the question if people are going to be treated differently by powerful law enforcement agencies based on their political beliefs, which, oh, by the way, has been what has been happening for the better part of the last decade, beginning with Lois Lerner's IRS under Obama. And now in full blossom across a range of issues. It's not just about Trump. It's about issues like Catholic voters raising, and we've raised on this show. Border policy, as we've talked about, too, not getting a lot of profile. Certainly, the D.C. press corps doesn't want to cover, doesn't want to spend a lot of time other than to applaud Eric Adams for putting migrants who've come to this country illegally into a $400 night hotel while you have veterans sleeping on the streets in New York City. Applaud him for his compassion. Pay no attention to the opportunity cost. Pay no attention to the underlying policy that puts 600 migrant families in New York City because it's the only way border states can get the federal government and the national media's attention on the issue. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Batya Ungar-Sargon. She's the deputy opinion editor at Newsweek, author of Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Batya, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've written recently about the cruelty, the cruelty of Biden's open border policy. Why is it cruel? He just wants people that are striving for a better life to be able to come to this country on their terms.
Right. You know, it's so interesting because it's cruel to them as well as being cruel to our own working class. If you look at the numbers right now, there are record numbers of deaths at the border, 609 migrant bodies found. And that's just in the direct area of the border. That doesn't include the bodies that have been found further north in Texas, in other areas in Arizona and Nevada. The trek to get here that Biden is incentivizing is so dangerous. Fully one-third of women who make that trek admit to having been sexually assaulted, raped, attacked in some way by the cartels. That's a third who were willing to admit it. You can imagine what the actual number is. Children talking about riding La Bestia, that train that goes through Central America, and watching other children fall off. And why are they coming in record numbers? Why have 2 million migrants made this dangerous, perilous journey? They will tell you if you ask them, because Biden welcomed us. Biden told us to come. It's just horrific. I mean, the danger to them. But of course, you know, to me, the real cruelty is what it does to our working class. You know, for the first time in 50 years, wages at the bottom are rising. For the first time, workers have some kind of leverage because the labor market is so tight. And what are we doing with that leverage? We're importing an entirely new working class from other countries.
And so with the tens of thousands of people that are coming in, you know, every month, why isn't it okay to send them to New York and to Washington, D.C.? I think that makes sense. And people who get on the bus, by the way, they're not forced there or kidnapped and put on a bus or taken. They sign up to go to New York and to Washington, D.C.
Yeah, you know, if you talk to Brandon Judd, who I spoke to last week, he's, the spokesperson for the Border Patrol, he'll tell you there isn't a single person on those buses who doesn't have a document with an address in New York City. They're not forcing anybody onto buses. It's so ironic, and, you know, it's worse than ironic, so hypocritical for cities, states like D.C., New York City, to call themselves sanctuary cities. And then when border states say, oh, okay, well, we've absorbed 2 million, you consider yourself sanctuary cities, how about you take a couple hundred? How about you take a few thousand? And they go crazy, right? It's just the hypocrisy is on full display right now. And like you said, they're putting them up now in hotel rooms, $400 a night. So let me understand this correctly. America's working class can never afford to buy a home, can never afford the American dream, but they have to sit there and watch their taxpayer dollars going to put up people who their first act in this country was to cross the border illegally, put them up in a $400 luxury hotel. I mean, it's the point here. You know, the point here is not to hide the hypocrisy. The point is to be brazen about the hypocrisy, because that shows you who's in charge, right? They're not even trying to hide it anymore. They want conservatives. They want the working class to know who's in charge and how hypocritical they can be, because they have the power to do so and nobody's going to hold them to account.
Right. Hypocrisy is a feature, not a bug of their status.
Exactly.
Because they operate above you, they're able to exempt themselves from the rules. And, oh, by the way, if you disagree, even if you happen to be from, say, the same country of origin as some of the migrant families, if you disagree, well, then you're racist. And then you just get dismissed out of hand.
No, 100%. 100%. I mean, scratch beneath the surface of 95% of accusations of racism, not 100%, but 95% of accusations of racism that come from the left, and you'll find a class divide where they have achieved elite status, right? And they're trying to hide that class divide from you, and so they call you racist so they don't have to talk about it. What's the class divide here? Well, why do they want all of these illegal immigrants here? Because they employ them, right? That's the status here. You know, these immigrants come to cities like New York, and then upper class professional elites can employ them as, you know, domestic servants or gardeners, landscapers. That's who's employing, you know, 50% of these people are professional class liberals living in coastal cities getting cheap labor. And they don't care about the working class. They don't care that a lot of these jobs are being taken from Americans. They just don't care because they're benefiting from it economically. And if you point that out, they call you racist.
Well, what's the latest with the Remain in Mexico?
Yeah, so that was a great Trump-era policy, which made a lot of sense, right? The argument was, if you're coming to America to claim asylum, right, but you're passing through Mexico to get here, well, Mexico is an asylum-accepting country, right? It's considered stable enough that it can accept asylees from places where, you know, for people who need political asylum, right? It's considered a sort of, you know, enough of a first-world country to do that, right? So if you're coming, let's say you're coming from Honduras, but you're passing through Mexico to get to America, you're passing through a country where you are safe, right? So the Remain in Mexico policy was brilliant. The Trump administration policy that said, look, you are safe in Mexico. You can wait there for your asylum case to be heard. By the way, the vast majority of these migrants, they're going to have their asylum cases denied if they ever show up in court because they are economic migrants. You know, I'm not judging them for that. You know, it makes perfect sense to try to come to a country where there's more economic opportunity, but let's not lie about who they are. So it was this great Trump-era policy where Border Patrol agents were allowed to turn migrants away and say, you have to wait in Mexico. Here's your number. Here's your date. In 2 years, you can come to court. And the Biden administration, you know, from day one promised they were going to get rid of it. And they were challenged in court, and the Supreme Court gave them the green light to get rid of it. And, you know, the night of the DHS raid, the night of the Mar-a-Lago raid, DHS announced that it was doing away with Remain in Mexico. So if you think that having 200,000 migrants crossing the border every month was bad up until now, just wait for what's coming.
Do we have any status update on Kamala Harris's work to get to the root causes?
That was her homework assignment.
Of the Northern Triangle countries' migration through Mexico to this country.
Listen, she's not wrong that, you know, helping address those root causes, right, creating a more stable, you know, rule of law in these countries will prevent, you know, that they will incentivize people to stay. She's not wrong about that. The problem is that we have to control our border as well, right? You can't just say, oh, we're going to, you know, some fluffy, airy-fairy, we're going to, you know, help you down there. You have to control the border while also supporting those countries. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that, right? They're our neighbors. Their problems are essentially, you know, on our border, right? But that has to be coupled with some kind of rule of law here, right? And that's what you're not seeing from the Biden administration.
Since you're very focused on the sort of scam that is run by the ruling class on middle-income families and, you know, people that are working their way up the economic ladder, I wonder what your reaction was to the sales pitch offered by the president on the so-called Inflation Reduction Act as it pertains to, you know, the IRS, and nobody under 400 grand is going to be paying a penny more in taxes. That doesn't seem to hold up under scrutiny. And all these additional subsidies to buy cars, electric vehicles that most middle-income families can't afford because they essentially come close to representing their annual household income.
You know, the rebate on buying an electric car reminded me of something. My gym recently replaced the Stairmasters, and the new Stairmaster has a little button you can press, and there's like a tiny little fan. You press the button and it blows air in your face, right? So it's like, on the one hand, it's nice to have a little bit of air blowing in your face. On the other hand, you're still on a torture machine, right? You're still on a Stairmaster, right? That's what this is, right? You get $12,000 back if you can afford a $60,000 car, right? So that you're exactly right. Who is this for, right? Well, for a working class person, you know, oh, sure, you know, like, you know, $12,000 back is great, but where am I going to get the $60,000? It's for upper-class people who want an extra car, and instead of buying a regular car, now they'll buy a Tesla, right, with the $60,000 they have just lying around, right? You know, so much of this bill was, you know, corporate welfare for corporations going green, and then these tax rebates for upper-class people who are buying electric cars. On the IRS thing, I just, you know, it's so much gaslighting. I think it's great. Go after rich people who are not paying their fair share. You know, we know that the IRS spends 85% of its energy going after people who make less than $75,000 a year because, you know, it's so much harder and more expensive to go after people who are rich. But so why couldn't they put that in as a part of the legislation? No, it has to be trust us, right? That trust us is just gaslighting. Why should we trust you? What have you done to earn our trust? You know, why couldn't they put that in the legislation? Of course they didn't.
Batya Unger-Sargon, deputy opinion editor at Newsweek, author of Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Batya, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy talking about, in part, subsidies for electric cars and the IRS Expansion and Growth Reduction Act that the big guy, that Mr. 10% signed on Monday.
It's a joke.
California, of course, California.
Yeah.
The reason we point it out is because if it's proposed in California, you can be sure it will at some point in the not-too-distant future be proposed in Illinois. There is legislation pending to give people tax credits for not having a car.
Okay.
$2,500 up to a maximum of $7,500 per household. Each person over 16 living in the household who doesn't own any vehicle eligible for an income tax credit of $2,500, an income tax credit on the money they're probably receiving from the government, but I digress, to a maximum of $7,500 per household. Yeah.
And the car, that's weird, but I mean, Biden's plan, you have to purchase the car and it has to be assembled in North America.
Well, that's a sop to the auto workers unions. I get it. But the tax credits for no car. So tax credits for the rich to buy high-end electric vehicles and tax credits for those who would be attracted to a tax credit like that, which would be mainly urban dwellers, lower income, get you back on mass transit because that's about the only way you will, although in L.A.
There's not a lot of options for mass transit.
No, exactly. So, yeah. Gosh, I wonder. It sounds very Klaus Schwabian to me, very much like end of private property. We need to deal with people who are clinging to the idea of owning things. And once we free them from being a stakeholder in capitalism, that's when we can usher in, well, the Great Reset as a call. But, of course, heaven on earth is what they intend. Yeah, it's a very, very Klaus Schwabian, very World Economic Forum sounding is this legislation being advanced by the Democrat Socialists in California. So we'll keep an eye on it as they, you know, try to dislodge you from your silly notions about having a stake in your community or this country by owning anything.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, Mr. 10% had this to say on Monday, refreshing your recollection. On the occasion of signing the IRS Expansion and Growth Reduction Act.
And I'm about to sign the Inflation Reduction Act into law, one of the most significant laws in our history. Let me say from the start, with this law, the American people won and the special interests lost. The American people won and the special interests lost.
Got it.
What? Who won? Who lost?
James Freeman has the drop on Bill Gates' influence in the process. I guess the Bill Gates, representative of the American people, regular folk, not a representative of the billionaire class who made big bets on solar and wind energy. Sure. Okay. Gates started wooing Manchin and other senators who might prove pivotal for clean energy policy in 2019 over a meal in D.C. Gates saying, "My dialogue with Joe Manchin has been going on for quite a while. Almost everyone on the Energy Committee," of which Manchin was then the senior most Democrat, "almost everyone on the Energy Committee came over and spent a few hours with me over dinner." As James Freeman writes in an excellent piece, "It sure is nice to be able to summon almost an entire congressional committee to one's dinner table." Yeah, it sure is. That's not a special interest, though. That's a bunch of people around the table looking out for the American people, don't you know? While this might prove challenging for the average American, Freeman continues, "there are a few interests in Washington more special than someone who sits atop a pile valued at north of $100 billion. Yeah. And, of course, Gates isn't the only one, but he's near the top of the pyramid, isn't he? And Gates, his investments through Breakthrough Energy, the Gates organization that does climate work, tens of millions into green cement startups such as EcoSem, Chemint, and Brimstone. None have yet reached commercial scale. He saw the bankruptcy filing of a battery startup he backed, Aquion, that might have had a fighting chance if energy storage tax credits were available. Right. So as Freeman asks sarcastically, "is there a more worthy cause for taxpayers than trying to turn such losing investments of Bill Gates's into winners?" For more on all of this, pleased to be joined again by Carol Roth. Carol Roth, former investment banker, entrepreneur, author of The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America. Carol, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Yeah, it's a real wonderful story of fighting for, you know, Bill Gates and the other little guys who've got big positions in alternative energy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, you know, we've been living through this historic wealth transfer from Main Street to Wall Street for a couple of years, and it's just continuing. I mean, it's very, very clear that the powers that be, the government, the Biden administration, all of the elites want nothing to do with the middle class, because an upwardly mobile middle class that's strong is basically an affront to centralized power, and it's the only thing that stands in their way from consolidating it. So they're going to do everything in their interest to make sure that the middle class basically owns nothing, as Klaus Schwab has put out into the ethersphere. And, you know, the More Inflation Act is just one of those things in a long list that they've been doing.
Now, you say more inflation. I'm a bit puzzled because I understand inflation to be zero. So in addition to your statement, I'm also confused by the Fed suggesting yesterday and the markets reacting to the fact they're going to continue to be aggressively raising interest rates to combat this inflation that, again, according to Mr. 10%, is at zero.
Yes, I forgot that inflation was at zero. I've been too busy bathing in my dollars to remember that. Yeah, no, it's just absolute lunacy. The fact that, you know, they keep slapping these, you know, wonderful labels on things, the fluffy puppy bill, the Inflation Reduction Act. As soon as it was passed, they completely dropped that. They just started touting the fact that it was a climate and health giveaway. And, you know, so that, you know, the pretending only went so far. And, you know, the fact of the matter that you have, you know, the Fed trying to destroy demand in the economy, you know, all while the government is trying to spend more money. Clearly, there is, you know, nobody who's on the same page. And we're just taking dollars that are, you know, productively within the private sector and transferring them to the government so they can allocate them to their pet projects in a non-productive way. And it's truly frightening to watch.
Well, I mean, obviously, there's nothing in the Inflation Reduction Act that's going to help people at the pump, that's going to, you know, see the lowering of prices in the grocery stores. But is this tax increase, will it worsen supply chain problems?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I mean, honestly, you know, they have some provisions, Amy, in there, like this 15% corporate minimum tax. A lot of that is window dressing. You know, there's less than 200 public companies that paid less than 15% tax, and you know, those who are caught up in this sort of alternative minimum tax for corporations will either slow down their investments, maybe not give raises in as big of a manner to their employees, or they're going to end up passing it along to the consumer. But, you know, I'm not sure that it will directly impact the supply chain any worse than all of their meddling has already messed everything up. And I think that you are entirely right. You know, instead of securing our national energy position and investing more in traditional energy, making sure we have economic and national security, you know, they're off being a venture capital firm so that their cronies can get lots of dollars and be powerful and wealthy, instead of looking at the security for all of America. And it's disgusting.
What's your handle on what's happening in the retail sector? I ask because the report yesterday was retail spend was flat month over month, although if you back out gas, it was up a bit. But then you have stories of a lot of big operators closing significant branches, a significant number of branches that they're sort of been phasing in over a couple of years. And I just since we talk a lot about manufacturing and supply chains, but at the end of the day, America's economy is mostly service sector, and so we need to keep right. our eye on the what's happening in the retail space.
Yeah, from a retail standpoint, one of the challenges is that retail is on a sort of a nominal basis, where when we look at something, let's say like GDP, we're looking at it on a real basis, which is adjusted for inflation. And so the challenge is that the consumer is still doing everything they can to spend, but on a real basis, those dollars are being eaten up by inflation. And unfortunately, consumers' balance sheets are under a ton of pressure. You've got the personal saving rate at the lowest level since the Great Recession financial crisis, and you have credit card debt up 13% this year. So there's a lot of pressure. We have seen this sort of switch from goods to services, which was expected coming out of the pandemic. But pretty soon here, I think that the consumer isn't going to be able to hold up even on a nominal basis, because inflation is just taking so much away. They're just not going to be able to keep up, and you're going to continue to see demand destruction at the same time that the Fed is intentionally trying to lower demand with their continued raises of interest rates, both at the consumer level and the business investment level. So I personally think that, kind of the pause that we've seen, where you've gotten some happier headline information, you need to kind of look past that. And I don't think that the real economic pain, other than obviously the inflation piece, but sort of the full recessionary piece, has come yet, and that's probably something that we start to see either late this year or early into next year.
Yeah, so if the Fed goes with a 75 basis point rate increase next month, then what happens in the fourth quarter? What do you think that looks like in terms of maybe starting to feel some of the pain? Is that with respect to housing? I mean, especially as you get into the colder months, home prices? Is it increased unemployment? What are we going to see?
Yeah, when we're already starting to see a little bit of a crack in housing, and I think that we'll see some there, although this crazy supply-demand imbalance and the fact that you have corporations looking to swoop up housing at bargain basement prices probably put some sort of a floor there. I think that you have the employment situation rolls over, and this big gap between jobs available and job seekers starts to really shrink, and unemployment rises. But again, given the number of people who are in the labor force and the number of open jobs, the numbers probably don't look as bad as what that you might see in a traditional systemic recession. So, you know, we're going to see things, and of course, they're not going to necessarily tell the story on the headline. You're going to have to look deeper into things like, you know, labor force participation and what the underlying data is telling us, not just the headline data.
There was a story out this week that some state attorneys general, including in Arizona, but not limited to, more than a dozen, want answers from BlackRock about their ESG orthodoxy and their investments that are based on their politics rather than based on return for, say, public sector pension funds at the state level around the country. Your reaction to that, and if that in any way could represent a break in terms of pushing back against, you know, the CRT of corporate America, which is ESG, sort of, if you will.
I've been calling it business social credit because that's basically what it is. It's a social credit score for corporations, and if you're not, you know, woke enough, and you're not, you don't have a certain number of diverse directors, and you're not investing in the types of projects that we want you to, we're going to leverage the fact that we have, you know, trillions of dollars under management, you know, to make you feel pain and to not allocate you capital, and it's really crazy. I'm thrilled to see these you know, different states do in different ways push back, you know, via antitrust, via you know, all different sorts of mechanisms. And you know, the nice thing about corporations is at the end of the day, they're economic animals. And in good times, you know, this crazy, you know, bull market that we've been in for a very long time, you know, they sort of have the ability to do these ridiculous things because the stocks keep going up because of the backdrop of the Fed's easy money. Now that that situation has shifted, if we get enough people who push back, the economic interests are going to prevail. And you've already seen, you know, different companies as well as countries sort of change their tenor. You know, you've got Europe who are saying that, you know, natural gas and nuclear, you know, now are considered okay under ESG if they do X and Y because they don't have enough energy. So I think that the economic interest and the push here could really turn this around. And this is a great place for individuals to get active, to, you know, call and support their attorney generals, to call you know, their representatives, and to frankly call the companies that they're working with and pull money if you can. You know, obviously you can't out of a state pension, but, you know, express your displeasure that, you know, you want companies focused on what's in your best interest as a shareholder, not on a host of political issues. You've got enough of that in your life. And I do think that this is an area where we can at least win temporarily, although they're already trying to rebrand it as impact investing. So don't let it come back under another name either.
Right. Yes. It's hard to kill these things. Carol Roth, former investment banker, entrepreneur, author of The War on Small Business, How the Government Used the Pandemic to Crush the Backbone of America. Carol, thanks as always.
Have a good time, guys.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Note here. Tomorrow, Chicago Police Officer Danny Golden is coming home from the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab. It's a incredible recovery from him being shot and paralyzed from the waist down several weeks ago outside of that bar in Beverly, as everybody knows. Chicago Police Department and other law enforcement agents are going to be escorting Danny Golden home, and supporters are asked to line the streets to show their support for hometown hero Danny Golden. 10 a.m. is when they leave the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab there in Streeterville, and they go Lakeshore Drive to the Dan Ryan, to 31st Street, to Wells, and, you know, all the way down to Pulaski, 103rd and Pulaski.
Yeah, so they're asking some people to line, you know, the overheads of Dan Ryan. You could go there and show your, you know, make a sign and show your support. And a lot of off-duty police officers are going to be outside the Shirley Ryan Institute.
Yeah, so, and if you want to see the whole route, and you can calculate the time if you want to show your support where you can show your support. I tweeted it out and also put it on Instagram at Dan Proft and stuff. So take a look at that and support Danny Golden and, by extension, law enforcement in Chicago. Question I have about law enforcement after reading this newly published paper from two Harvard eggheads. Are we under-policed and over-imprisoned? This is essentially what these Harvard academics argue, looking at the data from the study. The American criminal legal system is characterized by an exceptional kind of under-policing and a heavy reliance on long prison sentences compared to other developed nations. Well, at least in some jurisdictions in the country, not Cook County. In this country, roughly three people are incarcerated per police officer employed. The rest of the developed world strikes a diametrically opposite balance between these twin arms of the penal state, employing roughly 3.5 times more police officers than the number of people they incarcerate. It's almost 180. Three incarcerated per police officer employed in America, 3.5 times more police officers employed than people in prison in a lot of Western European nations. So they argue, I'm quoting, the United States has it backward. Justice and efficiency demand we strike a balance between policing and incarceration more like that of the rest of the developed world. And to respond to that assertion, pleased to be joined by Rafael Mangual, senior fellow and head of research for the Manhattan Institute's Policing and Public Safety Initiative. He's also the author of Criminal Injustice, What the Push for Mass Decarceration and Depolicing Gets Wrong, and Who It Hurts Most. Rafael, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back, Dan and Amy.
So what about that? I mean, we've talked about decarceration. You wrote about it again recently and who bears the brunt. What about the under policing? We don't have enough police officers, and not just with the flight from police departments since the pandemic, well, since the riots and over the last 2 years, but just generally, even pre-pandemic, we weren't at the levels that much of the rest of Western Europe is at, and that's what we should be talking more about.
Yeah, I mean, look, I do think that there is a case to be made that the United States can use a lot more policing than it currently has. The current, you know, recruitment and retention crisis that we've all been hearing about since the pandemic, as you noted, is really a sort of decade-long problem in the making. This is a trend that I think largely owes to the fact that in 1994, as a result of the crime bill passed that year, police departments around the country were able to hire collectively somewhere in the range of 70 to 100,000 more police officers. Now, you know, 20 years later, 2014, a lot of those cops became eligible for retirement, and there wasn't any other similar effort to backfill those positions. And of course, that sort of retirement or that career maturity coincided with a period in our sort of social history in which the institution of policing has been demonized in really incredible ways. If you just think about, you know, how historically that institution's been regarded in our society. And so I think the combination of those two things, the lack of investment and also the demonization of the institution, it kind of brought us to a point in which, yeah, I do think that there is a strong case to be made that we don't have enough police. I mean, and you can kind of see this from the studies that look at the effect of additional resources expended on policing. Every time one of those studies is done, what it finds is a pretty big return on investment, which tells you that there's still actually a lot of room in terms of progress to be made through the addition of more police.
And so, because the police presence matters. I mean, we're not talking about martial law. We're talking about things that we used to understand to be uncontroversial, like, you know, more beat cops, just police presence in the neighborhood, police relationships with residents and business owners, that matters.
Absolutely. Absolutely, it matters. I mean, people, you know, There's an old formulation of crime. It's called the routine activity theory of crime, and it posits that three things need to be present for crime to flourish. You need motivated offenders, you need vulnerable targets, but you also need an absence of capable guardians. Now, capable guardians can take many forms, but the most obvious form of a capable guardian that we all know and recognize is a police officer. And when a police officer is present, that is going to deter a significant amount of criminal activity in that area. Now, I do want to make clear that I think part of that deterrence owes to the fact that we also punish crime when people are caught and convicted. And so it's not clear to me that we can reap the same benefits from policing as we erode the broader criminal justice system around those efforts. And I think that, you know, one of the things that makes that really clear is just, you know, take the city of Chicago. The average person charged with a shooting or a homicide has 12 prior arrests.
Right.
More than 20% of them have more than 20 prior arrests. So, you know, the police can do a really good job of taking the problem individuals off the street and getting them in cuff. But if the rest of the system just spits them back out onto the street, then over time, you know, the deterrent effect of a police presence is going to get diminished.
Yeah, and that system is our progressive prosecutors, you know, in Chicago, in L.A., in New York. And George Soros is pretty much to blame. So how is George Soros getting it wrong?
Well, I think he's getting it wrong the same way lots of other people in that space are getting it wrong. I mean, he recently wrote an op-ed defending his support for quote-unquote progressive prosecutors in the Wall Street Journal, an op-ed to which I responded in City Journal. And, you know, he makes a lot of the same arguments that you hear. So, you know, we have a much higher incarceration rate than our Western European, sort of counterparts. Of course, this is observed by a lot of people on the reform side without any regard to the fact that we also have a much bigger homicide problem and a much bigger gun violence problem, which, you know, goes a long way toward explaining those things. I mean, it's not necessarily that we're more punitive than these other jurisdictions, right? In the UK, the mandatory minimum for illegal gun possession is 5 years in prison. And you're going to serve about 3.5 years of that sentence. Here in the United States, in a lot of cities, New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, you name it, that's an offense regularly met with probation. In Germany, a higher percentage of people convicted of murder are sentenced to life in prison than here in the U.S. When you hear these statistics, I think it starts to make clear that it's not necessarily that we're more punitive. We just have a lot more crime. Now, Soros really leans into the racial disparity question in his op-ed. I mean, that's the sort of one statistic that he gives. But of course, this you know, kind of ignores an important reality. He points to the higher likelihood of a Black American being incarcerated as compared to a white American without actually considering whether there are other disparities that might be informing the one that he's seizing on. And the implication is that the vast majority of those incarcerations are unjust and the result of racial animus. But, you know, this is an argument made in ignorance of the research that's been done on this topic. And I'll just quote one piece of research, which is a 2014 book-length report from the National Academy of Sciences, hardly a right-wing reactionary shop. And what they find is, quote, racial bias and discrimination are not the primary causes of disparities in sentencing decisions or rates of imprisonment. Overall, when statistical controls are used to take account of offense characteristics, prior criminal records, and personal characteristics, Black defendants are on average sentenced somewhat, but not substantially more severely than whites. You know, this is the thing. They harp on these top-level disparities without actually asking what, if any, other factors might be leading to those disparities that can offer a race-neutral explanation for their existence.
Yeah, of course they do. And they've been doing it for decades, just like they are prattling on about gun control, and then they don't want to enforce gun laws and impose stiff penalties, as you were describing before. Everything is a hustle with these people and these people that Soros has helped put in office as well. They're just preternaturally dishonest. I mean, in addition to the study you cited, I mean, the look at the scholarship of Roland Fryer, the economist from Harvard University, who's a Black gentleman, on these charges of, you know, racial profiling and white cops on the hunt to kill Black young men and so on and so forth. There's just no evidence to support any of it, but it just doesn't stop the demagoguery. So I guess you have to get to people that still retain some sense, some semblance of critical thinking capacity. I wanted to get your, you mentioned about criminal justice systems breaking down, and so Cook County is base camp for that. Get your reaction to the impact that this data point has, what this tells you about the criminal justice system, what it should tell the law abiding. Last year in Chicago, 74 people were accused of killing or shooting or trying to shoot or kill someone in the city while awaiting trial for another felony. In other words, you have violent people that are electronic monitored out, that are no cash bailed before even we have formally no cash bail in the state of Illinois when that's banned effective January 1. And they go out and those 74 people victimized another 111 people while they were out awaiting trial for a felony.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, these are, I think the best way to understand those kinds of things are as the vast majority being avoidable tragedies, right? These are individuals who could have been but were not incarcerated at the time because somewhere there was a breakdown in the system in which an individual, a judge, a prosecutor, decided that it was not worth the cost to the defendant to keep that person incarcerated despite the risk they posed to the public. That's a political choice. It's a political choice that creates a political problem that requires a political solution. What I can tell people is that if you look at the data on bail reform efforts in Chicago, in New York, and lots of other cities, what you'll find is an increase in the aggregate number of crimes committed by the pretrial population. A lot of people lean into studies showing that the rate of criminal offending doesn't change for people who are pretrial defendants pre and post reforms, right? There was a study of Chicago, of Cook County's bail reform effort that made this claim from two scholars at Loyola. And it's true that the rate of offending does not change. But when you increase the number of pretrial defendants, if that pool of people offends at the same rate, it's still a greater number of crimes than you otherwise would have had.
Right.
Right. 50% of 100 is less than 50% of 1,000. Right. And so that is the thing that I don't think people have quite yet gotten, that a lot of scholars have obfuscated. And this matters. And so the question is for the voting public, are you okay with that? Right? Are you okay with taking the sorts of risks that are inherent in the release of people who have proven through their actions time and again that they have no intention of living by society's rules? And are you okay with imposing those risks, if we're speaking frankly, on the very small slice of communities in the city of Chicago that actually stand to see the majority of the crime that those individuals are going to commit, right? In any given city in America, about 5% of street segments are going to see 50% of all crime, right? The 10, in my book, I look at the 10 most dangerous community areas in Chicago. They have a collective murder rate of 60 per 100,000, in excess of that, actually. And then I compare that to the 28 community areas in the city of Chicago that had one or fewer murders in 2019, and they had a collective homicide rate of around 2 per 100,000, right? So when we're talking about these risks, we have to understand that they are going to be just as disparately, if not more disparately, spread than a lot of the costs associated with enforcement that we hear so much about from people like George Soros.
That's such a great point, and that breakdown is so important for all these people that pretend that they're providers, guardians, to use your word, of those that are less fortunate, those that live in crime-infested neighborhoods and so forth and have for a long time. I always remember this data point. And by the way, this is against the backdrop yesterday of four teenage boys shot on a porch in Inglewood, one of those high-crime districts.
6-year-old.
The average life expectancy. Average life expectancy where I live in Streeterville in Chicago, 90 years old. Average life expectancy 7 miles away in Inglewood, 60 years old.
Unbelievable.
That 30-year difference, I can't repeat this enough, that 30-year difference is the largest spread of any two neighborhoods in the city, in a city, in the country. And what does that tell you?
Yeah.
60 per 100,000. The 60 per 100,000 murder rate in those 10 neighborhoods you were mentioning, I think the overall in Chicago is 12 per 100,000. 5X. So, you know, I mean, do you want to get serious about this or not?
Yeah, and I would note that those 10 neighborhoods that I mentioned are 95% Black and Hispanic.
Of course, of course.
Right, so if we care about racial disparities, right, the question that I ask people like George Soros in the piece and other people who really harp on those, you know, disparate outcomes with respect to enforcement is, I understand that these disparities make you uncomfortable, but why doesn't the disparity in victimization rates make you equally uncomfortable? Why can you live with the fact that in my home city of New York, a minimum of 95% of all shooting victims every single year for which we have data are either Black or Hispanic? This is going back to 2008. Every single year. That is one of the starkest and most persistent racial disparities in the criminal justice data sphere. You hear almost nothing about it from the progressive reformers. Why? Why is that okay? Why does that not require an urgent response? Why doesn't that overwhelm the case that's based on disparities in enforcement?
Right. Where's
this is the question I've yet to get a good answer to.
Where's the equity, right, Raphael? Equity, that word you throw on, where is it? Raphael Mangual, Senior Fellow and Head of Research for the Manhattan Institute's Policing and Public Safety Initiative. Check out his new book, Criminal Injustice, What the Push for Mass Decarceration and Depolicing Gets Wrong and Who It Hurts Most. Criminal Injustice, Raphael Mangual. Raphael, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me back, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy and former President Trump wants to be relatively even keel about the raid and the ongoing criminal investigation into, well, what do we know? Is it really into the handling of classified documents, or is this still mainly, if not exclusively, about January 6th? Hard to know. But Don Jr., less bounded by,
this is by a little crazy.
Those norms, he took to social media to let it all hang out.
My father says that he would have given them what they wanted had they done this, but no, they needed the FBI hostage rescue team, the HRT, their elite tactical unit, and 30-something agents to show up to my father's home, where they then wouldn't allow or didn't want any lawyers present, right? Because I'm sure, given all of the examples of totally above board stuff that the FBI done, that's totally great, right? Like, I don't know. If I'm the FBI, you want someone's lawyer there so that there can be no other claims later on. But, you know, honestly, they don't care. At this point, like, given all of the things that they seem to have fabricated or lied about and all of these things, guess what, folks? There's exactly zero equal justice under the law. You know what? Pro tip for life. This is an ultimate life hack. Become a Democrat. Then you can do whatever you want with no accountability, no law, legal action. They'll just leave you alone, okay? But you needed the HRT to exercise this warrant at Mar-a-Lago. Give me a break, right?
I understand his rage, though. I mean,
he's channeling the reaction to a significant percentage of the from a significant percentage of the population. There's no question about that. For more on the legal aspects of this imbroglio, pleased to be joined again by Professor Alan Dershowitz, Messer Emeritus Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. His podcast, The Dersh Show, can be found on Spotify, YouTube, and iTunes. His most recent book, The Price of Principle, Why Integrity is Worth the Consequences. Professor Dershowitz, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks. And this morning on in Newsweek magazine, I have an op-ed about why the affidavit must be made public, because half of America doubts the FBI's account of what happened. Whether they're right or wrong, I don't know. I wasn't there. But getting the affidavit, even in redacted form, will at least help to explain what they were after. Why did they get a warrant to go into a locked safe and bring the locksmith to open the safe? They found nothing in it. Why did they go into the closet of Mrs. Trump and look through her clothes? Did the warrant have a basis for that, or is that something just the FBI decided to do? These are the questions
that need answering. And in America, we favor transparency over secrecy. And so I hope that Judge Reinhart this afternoon will say to the government, look, you want to keep it secret? Come to my chambers and explain to me every word that you want redacted. And if you can't justify a word being redacted, it gets made public. So we get to see 90% of the affidavit. That's the way it should be.
Why didn't they just get a subpoena? I still scratch my head over that.
They should have gotten a subpoena. They did, well, they did get a subpoena, and they negotiated over the subpoena. And what people miss is this. If they weren't satisfied with the negotiations over the subpoena, you just go to court and enforce the subpoena. The judge will say then, turn the boxes over to me, the judge. He could then go over the content, decide what was classified, what was declassified, what was privileged. Maybe there'd be an invocation of some privileges by the president's lawyers. But no, they went in and they just searched. And even Garland said in his statement, the Justice Department's policy is to use less intrusive methods whenever possible. And let's see if the affidavit explains why it wasn't possible here to continue in the affidavit route rather than to go the much more intrusive search route.
Yeah, and all the invocations of transparency. I mean, this is kicking and screaming. It was took 4 days for Merrick Garland to come out and make any sort of statement without taking questions. It took 5 days to get a copy of the property receipt and some of what they wanted us to see, like the reference to the Espionage Act, so that the talking heads could blather on about that for a weekend. And now we're hearing what we always hear from the FBI and DOJ, jeopardize an ongoing investigation to release the underlying basis for attempting to and securing the search warrant. Did they make any material misrepresentations to the court? Because why shouldn't we be skeptical of these people?
And there is a right to have what's called a Franks hearing to see whether or not there were misrepresentations. Look, I've been in this business of secrecy for more than half a century. I was one of the lawyers representing the Pentagon Papers. And in the Pentagon Papers case in front of the Supreme Court, I remember it vividly, the Solicitor General of the United States represented to the Supreme Court that if the Pentagon Papers are revealed, the national security of the United States would be permanently damaged. And, of course, the papers were revealed, and there was no damage at all. The government always exaggerates the need for secrecy, which is why you need to guard the guardians. You need judicial supervision of the government, and that's why you should get subpoenas. That's why there should be disclosure of the affidavit today. I hope that happens. I'm a little doubtful, but who knows?
And you also wrote recently, too, about the comparisons that are being invoked in terms of the disparate treatment from DOJ and FBI as it relates to, for example, Hillary Clinton and her handling of classified documents versus Trump, and why those comparisons are perfectly legitimate.
Not only legitimate, but necessary. In a government under the rule of law and equal protection, you always have to ask, why was A treated differently from B? Was it a question of political affiliation? Was it a question of race? Was it a question of gender? Whataboutism is the essence of equal protection, and yet Hillary Clinton, who was my friend, mocked it with her hat, and the hat that said, but her emails. Yeah, but her emails are important, but Sandy Berger, stuff in classified material, he was a friend of mine too, in his sock. That's important. You should always ask, what about this person? What about that person?
Well, what about President Obama? Because he took a bunch of documents and said that he was going to, you know, send the information, like set screenshots of that and send the information back to the National Archives Library, and not one has been submitted yet.
Well, all these things are fair game, and all these questions should be asked, and they shouldn't be mocked. Look, I've been making the whataboutism argument for years and years and years about Israel, for example, at the United Nations. They condemn Israel for building a settlement, and I say, what about Turkey? What about Iran? What about Iraq? What about China? Why don't you condemn them? Those are fair questions to ask. What about is an essence of equal protection.
What about the response that President Trump offered, saying that there was a standing order to declassify any material that was removed from the Oval Office and taken into residence that was deemed to be declassified? There's pushback from not exactly friends of the president, like John Bolton, who said, well, if there was such a thing, I didn't know about it, and that such a thing would have to be memorialized somewhere. This notion of, is there anything even there if, when he had the power as the executive to classify and declassify, if there was such some sort of standing order to declassify everything I'm taking?
Yeah, well, my friend John Bolton, who I admire enormously, is wrong about that, too. There needn't be any kind of memorialization. For example, President Bush once declassified items in the middle of a meeting just by orally stating they're declassified. It is a question of fact. You can't go back now
two years later and say,
retroactively, I declassified.
Right.
But if there is factual proof that he declassified, it could be oral proof, it could be just witnesses, then the declassification operates. Look, we need to change the declassification laws. There should be less classification. There should be a process by which things are classified and declassified so that the public can know what is classified and what is not. Right now, it's just the Wild West, and we have just no idea what the rules are, what the practice is, what the tradition is. And when the rules are unclear, you do not use a criminal prosecution.
Based on your vast experience and close observation, do you think that the DOJ and FBI are on the level here and this is just about these documents, or is this a feint because they're really doing a fishing expedition around 1-6?
Well, it could be both. It could be they have a legitimate interest in classification, but they would also love to see if they can find stuff about January 6th. The affidavit may give us a clue as to that. We don't know. And the FBI often will do that. We'll go search for one thing legitimately, but then, you know, under the plain view doctrine, you can seize anything that you can see. And FBI agents have incredible peripheral vision when it comes to plain
sight
doctrine.
Yeah.
As a way of fighting back, Trump is considering releasing surveillance footage of the FBI raid on his house. Do you think that's a good idea, a sound idea?
I think it should be disclosed. Look, I have a policy. It's one of the things I argue in my book, The Price of Principle. If you have conflicting views about something, and one side says, turn it all out, dispose it, unclassify, display it. The other side said, no, keep it secret. I generally believe the side that wants to disclose everything. Secrecy is not consistent generally with credibility. And so, I would hope that the judge would split the difference and say, come into chambers, tell me every word, every sentence, every name you think you should have redacted. I'll rule word by word, and I'll disclose anything in the affidavit that you can't prove to me is necessary for the continuation of the investigation. That's the right way to do it.
Yeah. You know, it's only bloodsuckers that don't like sunlight. That's sort of my spin on Louis Brandeis' sunlight is the best disinfectant. How do you like that?
That's a wonderful phrase. I didn't know that. I'll have to use that from now on.
See, but quote Dan Pryor.
There you go. Please, attribution.
Attribution. Yeah.
Professor.
Absolutely.
Professor Alan Dershowitz, Emeritus Professor of Law, Harvard. Podcast, The Dersh Show, can be found at Spotify, YouTube, and iTunes. The book, the new book, The Price of Principle, Why Integrity is Worth the Consequences. Professor Dershowitz, thanks as always.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.